Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming to this faculty council and town hall meeting. I was speaking at the Osler Fellows mid-season seminar, and I said that two of the primary functions of the university were to protect and preserve history and invent the future. And that somehow transmogrified into protecting our history and inventing our future, which is not a bad title for this afternoon's session as we consider how to continue the McGill trajectory of excellence at a time of very constrained resources. I'd like to begin, as custom dictates, by taking a few moments to recognize in memory those who have left the faculty. If you would all stand. Dr. Simon Gold, Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Dr. Allison McDonald, Professor Emerita, Department of Epidemiology. Dr. Peter Macklem, Professor Emeritus, Department of Medicine. And if we could have a moment of silence. Thank you. Today we're going to review some faculty news, have a special award presentation by Marty Crisworth. We welcome back from his triumphal tour of Italy the provost, Professor Anthony Massey, who did some wonderful things in Europe in the last 10 days. And then we'll have our usual open forum to focus in particular on the blending of the strategic planning activities at the faculty and at the university in the context of this difficult financial season. I'd like to begin by telling you how grateful I am for all of you who in the continuing winter have been dislodged, have been disrupted in your activities as we function for the greater good with the modifications to the McIntyre, the departments of pharmacology and biochemistry and physiology, in particular, the disruptions that have occurred and your generosity of spirit and fact that we're able to take advantage of these moments of largesse from the federal government, and there aren't many, for science to benefit everyone. So thank you very much, those of you involved in all of these things. Faculty news and spreading the word remains a tremendous difficulty, an extraordinary challenge in the late 21st, in the beginning of the 21st century. In the summer of 1950, at a conference in Amsterdam, the famous sociologist of science, Derek Price, presented his theory on the expansion of scientific knowledge. And in that year, he calculated that the doubling rate of science was 10.4 years, which is extraordinary if you think about it in 1950, but not extraordinary as the next estimation. 60 years later, at something called the Techonomy Conference in the summer of 2010, the former Google CEO, Eric Schmidt, provided an update to Price's estimation. And he said that every 2 days, we create as much information as we did from the dawn of civilization until 2003. That is 5 exabytes of data. An exabyte is roughly 2 × 10⁻¹⁸. A small difference probably from that number, but it doesn't really matter. In those 60 years, that is the change in the pace of the production of information. And so we compete, the faculty, your departments, with all of the other sources of modern information for your attention. And it's very difficult. So we take the opportunity to discuss some of what is happening at the faculty. We had a wonderful moment at another atrium across the way last week when we introduced Dr. Mark Lathrop, this gentleman, as the new director of the McGill Genome Quebec Innovation Center. And flanked by the president of Genome Quebec and the minister of the MDIE, the principal, myself, he gave an extraordinary speech about the faculty, the founding of the Innovation Center, and what he anticipated being able to do with the tools that we are giving him, which are, in fact, substantial, and which he will enhance with the international collaborations for which he is known. So that was one of the very good moments. Before the National Assembly on December 9th, the Minister of Health, Yves Bolduc, introduced Bill 127, an act to improve the management of the health and social services network. And this is not such good news. It describes what the board of directors of every healthcare institution in the province would be like, and it reduces the number of board members of the largest of the affiliates, the SHUs, to a maximum of 15 members, of whom only one, previously four, only one will be from the university. And it proposes a variety of other changes which would exclude the university from automatic participation in the selection of directors general, of the strategic planning exercises, which are required by the bill, and in general, create a separation which goes precisely against the direction created by the invention of the RUIS, the 4 geographic health care delivery systems in the province that are tethered each to one of the 4 universities with faculties of medicine. So McGill has been leading a coalition of the willing across the province to let the ministry know that we think there are flaws in the bill, though it does give a nod to modern governance principles. And virtually every organization, the SHUs, the ACES, which represents 140 healthcare institutions, the 4 universities with faculties of medicine, all of the other universities through the CREPUC, have followed our lead in proposing that they be allowed to address the Commission Parlementaire, which will begin on March 15th. To understand that this is a time, in particular, when the relationship between the university, the academic center, and the clinical center has to be closer, not further away, and that taking these steps actually is a hindrance to the accomplishment of that 21st century goal. So we will be represented by members of the four universities. Sam Benaroya will be our spokesperson for the description of how this will affect us. And we have hopes, based on all of the documents that have been filed with the ministry, and those to be filed at the Commission, that modifications to this bill will, in fact, take place. One of the many elements in which we interact with the government on a whole host, a whole range of topics, from education to care. In the category of news of late, beginning in the life science complex where we are now, taking this movable feast, we've been over in the McIntyre, at the Montreal General, at the Jewish, at the Children's, and now here in the life science complex for our faculty council meetings. What's going on? So much that this is just a soupçon. This is just a little kernel of the things that the faculty is responsible for. Recently, Alan Nepveu and colleagues reported a new test, which they discovered that better predicts breast cancer outcomes. A very prominent article in the media that uses genetic techniques to describe this. And in this area, very great activity here at McGill, with a pilot project also aiming to make use of an area of great expertise here at the Goodman Cancer Research Center in particular, which is understanding the metabolic changes that occur in cancer cells, as well as the genetic or genomic changes, and trying to combine those two in the laboratory of Julie Saint-Pierre and Vincent Giguère, working on combining these two to make stronger statements about the nature of cancer. And forthcoming very shortly, promising work underway that I can't tell you too much about, but to be published soon, understanding mechanisms involved in IBD, inflammatory bowel disease, work coming from the laboratory of Maya Sala and others, explorations in immunodeficiency from Philippe Gros' complex trait group, and a very recent agreement signed between us, Dave Thomas and John Hanrahan, in the orphan diseases group with GlaxoSmithKline to take a hard look at a breakthrough approach to cystic fibrosis. In the awards and honors column, we celebrate the first laureate of the CIHR Institute, Bhagirath Singh Early Career Award in Infection and Immunity, given to Martin Schmeng. We note the recipient of an honorary doctorate from the Institut Camille Jordan in Lyon, France, Dr. Mike Mackey, a recipient of the Barony Society's Halpeak Nylon Medal, I hope that's the way one says those words, for recognition of outstanding contributions to vestibular science, given to Kathleen Cullen, and the recipient of the Zellers Senior Scientist Award from the Canadian Cystic Fibrosis Foundation to Dr. Gergely Lukacs. So just a very small portion of the honors that this faculty receives on a regular basis. If we move to the wards and the labs, at the RIMUHC, the Lady Davis and the Jewish General combined, indicating that wonderful hint of the academic health network still to be formed with constant collaboration across all sites. Researchers have pinpointed a gene responsible for tumor development. This, too, was in the media, and Will Foulkes described discovering the answer to a mystery. Someone walked into the Jewish in 1976 with tumors affecting the stomach and colon, and it's taken this time and genetic, modern genomic techniques to uncover the reason why, and it's a significant breakthrough. At the Lady Davis, the description of a new antibiotic for C. difficile, the organism responsible for so much morbidity for hospitalized patients, and at the MUHC, the first patient receiving a new kind of artificial heart, if you will, an assist device that pumps blood by squeezing the aorta. Just in the things we've discussed thus far, the remarkable breadth for which we are known at McGill in the life sciences. Continuing on, St. Mary's Research Center, Dr. Susan Law, who is the Vice President for Academic and Scientific Affairs at St. Mary's, announced the birth of St. Mary's Research Center. We have been collaborating intensely with St. Mary's in developing their research interests over the last few years, and they have decided to put this into a research center, and we wish them the best of success with that. At the MNI, the discovery of a new way that tumor cells invade normal tissue, the process of metastasis, by taking a hard look at the sticky proteins known as cadherins, which are responsible for adhesion of cells to each other and the underlying surfaces on which they grow. And at the end of last year, the celebration of the arrival and creation of a new professorship, the Pfizer Canada Professorship in Prevention of Dementia, Alzheimer's disease, and this goes to a new colleague, Dr. John Breitner, who has come to McGill from Seattle to advance his studies on Alzheimer's disease and, in particular, prevention. And he mentioned a remarkable figure at this celebration of the professorship, which was that, in essence, in another 30 years, if we do not have breakthroughs in the prevention of this disease, we would wind up spending more on that disease alone than the national annual budgets of Canada and the United States. So it is imperative, it is critical that we find ways to avoid this plague. And John Breitner is here to help us do that. In the schools of the faculty, in nursing, Dr. Carmen Loisel was appointed the Christine and Herschel Victor Hope and Cope Chair in Psychosocial Oncology. We wish her the best as well with that new chair. McGill has extended its physical therapy programs, as you see in this picture, at a signing ceremony to the University du Québec à Chicoutimi, UCAC, as it's colloquially referred to. And there are two new communication sciences and disorders research initiatives in reading, writing, and spelling and literacy for children. So once again, an extraordinary spectrum of activities in just this few months since we met previously, that characterize in part the remarkable work that continues despite the economic times, despite the difficulties that we face. And I would like now to take a break from the news and ask Marty Crisworth to come up and present an award for excellence in service to graduate and postdoctoral studies. Marty?
I'd like to first thank Dean Levin and the faculty for inviting me to your council meeting in order to present a grad studies award. It's a great pleasure to be here, and it's one of the certainly the best parts of my job. I'd like Christine LaBerge to come forward. What I'm going to do now is read the citation that that Christine received for this award, and there's also a plaque that goes with it. The Award for Excellence in Service to Graduate and Postdoctoral Studies is given each year to a member of McGill's administration and support staff who best represents what McGill has to offer in helping our graduate students and postdoctoral fellows. Exceptionally this year, there were two winners. And the quality of the of both of these winners was just extraordinary. We don't normally do that, but we could not decide. And there is another person out there, I'm pleased to say, that was almost as good as Christine. It's with great pleasure that I present one of this year's awards to Ms. Christine LaBerge, Student Affairs Coordinator in the Department of Biochemistry. Ms. LaBerge has been in the department since 2003 and has held her current position since 2007. She has contributed significantly to graduate studies, providing advice, clear and accessible communication, and outstanding service to graduate students. To quote Jason Young, the program director for biochemistry, Christine always keeps calm, listens, and comes up with answers, something all of us should probably try to do. Reliable, knowledgeable, and efficient, with tremendous problem-solving skills, Ms. LaBerge is known as a person who gets the work done and, more importantly, ensures follow-ups are taken care of. She is always looking for new challenges and innovations, and I'm pleased to see that she has been putting some of these innovations in at biochemistry that are very much like the kinds of things we're trying to do across the university. For example, she has set up a database of applicants to the program with secure login for faculty members so they can actually peruse documents for admission. She's also done one of her recent achievements is putting together the kind of funding packages for graduate students in her department. Described in a letter by a graduate student as always eager to help to the best of her abilities and is able to brighten one's day with her cheerful and friendly nature, Ms. LaBerge's dedication and commitment to students has earned her the admiration and gratitude of all who have come to depend upon her. On behalf of graduate and postdoctoral studies, I'd like to thank you, Christine.
This way. Come this way a bit. Okay. Okay.
I'll do one more like this. Excellent. The final one, superb. Thank you.
I just want to thank you very much for this honor and also mention the students and the professors in the Department of Biochemistry. They are my biggest supporters, and for that I thank them very much. Thank you.
In the second part of this meeting, we're going to have an opportunity to engage, as we like to do at least once a year, with the provost of the university, Tony Massey, on the academic matter of strategic directions in these times. I'm going to ask Tony to present to you. I have some slides that may answer some of the questions that he raises, and then we'll have the opportunity to take a look and discuss with you in open forum the directions of the university as a whole and this faculty, which is such an important component of it. So, Professor Massey, the floor is yours.
Well, it's always a pleasure to come have an opportunity to address the Faculty of Medicine and to talk a little bit about the the university's position as we move forward in the next couple of years. What I wanted to do is to talk about something that I've labeled tentatively as ASAP 2012, which is just achieving strategic academic priorities, and basing it a bit on what had been done in 2006 with the Strengths and Aspirations paper that was produced as McGill's first formal strategic planning document. That's not to say that McGill didn't plan in the past. It's just that it was not presented in the same way. What we wanted to do, I want to do today, is just outline a bit McGill's context, give you a sense of what some of the special circumstances in our economic realities are compared to the universities to which we normally compare ourselves, take a look at how we our multi-year budgeting overview, look at that resource gap and figure out how we can address it by an initiative called the Strategic Reframing Initiative that was launched by the principal in the early fall, actually started in almost 11 months ago, and then look at the purposes, principles, and objectives of an academic plan for 2012 through 16, and then hope to get some feedback from people who are here. The context right now, if people think about it, it's 2011 is the 190th anniversary of the founding of the university. And we've made some progress since 2006. Remember, when we came off of the decade of the 1990s, we were at an all-time low in terms of the number of professors that we had had. We were down from a high of over 1,400 professors at the beginning of the 1990s to fewer than 1,200 by the time that decade came to an end. And one of the things we tried to do in the 2006 strategic directions, the strengths and aspirations, was to make sure we could put resources to renewing the academic staff at the university. We also wanted to make sure that we did that in the context of improvements in our information technology. We would increase graduate student numbers and funding, which we've done, and also try to advance the experiences of our students in terms of their learning and living on our campuses. But there is a cost to that progress, and one of them is, of course, we live in a difficult financial situation in this province, and we need to think about new ways of doing things. I think we've taken our incremental changes as far as we can, and I'll come to that in terms of the budget, but we can't really do much more by simply doing what we're doing better. We have to think about doing new things. McGill is facing continued economic uncertainty. It isn't that the effects of the financial crisis of 2008 have left us completely. In fact, they work their way through our system because of our dependence on an endowment and a three-year rolling average. They work their way through our system rather slowly. But we have a projected shortfall for fiscal year 2012 that is very significant. It's in the order of $17 to $19 million of expected expenses above our projected revenues. Part of it comes from 4 years ago. We entered into agreements on increasing salaries, not just for our academic staff, but for sessional contract academic staff a couple of years ago. We've also agreed with our administrative and support staff to have a programmed approach to salary increases. There are collective agreements that have put in effect. 2008 really was disruptive from the point of view of being able to meet those commitments. We're going to meet them. They might take 4 years instead of three, but we're going to meet the commitments that we made on salary adjustments. Every 3 years, the provincial government requires all pension plans that are in the public sector to undergo a triennial evaluation. And when they undertook that evaluation in December of 2009, the results didn't come in until nearly the end of October of 2010. But the results were that we're required to make additional contributions to the pension plan. And those contributions come off of the operating budget of the university. I mentioned before the dependence on the the dependence on the endowment. Well, 2008 was a very bad year. 2009 got a little better, but it still wasn't 2007, and 2008 wasn't 2007, and 2009 wasn't as good either. So what we wound up with is, right now, the three worst years of the decade are the payout, the size of our endowment payout. And we've also reduced the payout from 5% to 4.25%. So we're facing about a $2 million shortfall from endowment income for the year. And we're still, the endowment is growing, the interests, the dividends and interests are up, but it's still not made up for by the fact that we do a three-year rolling average. We also have significant claims on operating budget resources to cover some of the deferred maintenance problems we have at the university. We have a very old stock of buildings. Some of the buildings that are undergoing renovations we find additional difficulties with. If any of you have been to the James Administration Building recently, it's a small project to replace something in the machine room, turned out to have an asbestos problem. That wasn't calculated in the capital cost, so we had to cover the asbestos removal from the operating budget. These things happen quite often. We are right now carrying an accumulated deficit in cash of about $100 million. And it's very inexpensive for McGill to borrow right now. We can borrow from the bank for up to 90 days for less than a percent. So it's not that onerous. But interest rates are targeted to increase. So if we have $100 million and we're borrowing at 1%, it's $1 million off of the operating budget. If those interest rates go up to 3%, we'll have to take $3 million out of the operating budget just to cover the interest on the accumulated deficit of the university. Now, 5 and 3 might play off of each other, but remember, the endowment fund takes 3 years to phase in. We also know that we've not been as competitive as we should be for some of the large-scale research competitions. The dean mentioned before that we had attracted Mark Lathrop here with a special program, that we had attracted Breitner here with, he didn't mention that, but with a special program. So part of it, part of what we need to be able to do is to set aside a significant amount of money to make ourselves more competitive for some of the larger scale research grant competitions that we anticipate will be coming either from Quebec or from Ottawa, as well as being able to do some international competitions. And then we have special constraints by being a university in Quebec. The one I always mention, and students don't often like to hear it, but it is tuition fees are extremely low in Quebec. Average tuition in Quebec for our students is about, for Quebec students, is $2,000. Average across the country is $5,000. If that's just for undergraduate students, that's a $3,000 per student difference. Times 20,000 students is $60 million. That's the entity that we're dealing with. It's a big difference that our competitors are able to have that we don't. 10 years ago, we might have been willing to live with that because the Quebec government was the most generous province in the country with regard to the grant that it provided for undergraduate and even graduate studies. But that's no longer the case. We've fallen to fourth, and we might soon fall to fifth place in terms of the support per student that our provincial government gives. So it's the worst combination. You have low tuition, and now you don't even have sufficient government grants to cover the difference. So our competitiveness suffers by being in Quebec. We're having our tuition rates regulated in the way in which they are in Quebec. The government made changes. Some of them are actually quite good. Using generally accepted accounting principles that everybody can understand is actually a positive move compared to what we had before, which were the MELS, or McGill, the Ministry of Education, Sports, and Leisure, one of the best combinations in the country. But those accounting rules actually are the ones that I just used to mention our cash deficit of $100 million. When you do generally accepted accounting principles, a lot of things that aren't cash actually have to enter into a calculation of your total indebtedness. So it looks a lot worse now than it did before. In fact, our total indebtedness jumps from $100 million to $280 million when you consider generally accepted accounting principles. Now, they were always, always in the financial statements of the university. They were just in notes because Mel's didn't want them on the sheets. But now they're in the sheets, and they're visible for everyone. There's also research is fundamental to McGill's definition of itself. We're a research-intensive university. And research entails what are sometimes referred to as indirect costs. Things like running an optical backbone network for the entire university, having a library system that actually subscribes to the electronic and other journals that people need to do their research. So the indirect costs of research, removing hazardous waste, right, all of those things, are actually not covered by the indirect costs that we can get on federal or even provincial grants. So we have to subsidize some of those indirect costs off of the operating budget of the university. I mentioned the tuition differential before. And in addition to Bill 127 that the dean mentioned with regard to governing bodies for hospitals, there's also a Bill 100 that is requiring reduced expenditures in all public and parapublic entities, and they're actually line item controlling it. It's not that we have to take a 2% cut. It's that we have to actually show we've reduced expenditures on certain types of expenditures, including entertainment. The multi-year budget overview, we had a target for fiscal year 2010 of $5 million deficit. In 2010, again, using the pre-GAAP calculation, the real cash deficit, it was $7.4 million. So we missed by 50% if you did it that way. But most of that was because we had a timing issue in moving to GAAP accounting. Let me try to explain that more clearly. We had what were called a retirement incentive plan for professors. The professors retired under that plan on the 80 of them retired on the 31st of May, 2010. So what happens is we thought we would pay that off starting June 1st, but the accounting system that was introduced requires us to book the expense in the year in which it's incurred. So the entire payouts for those retirement incentives were booked in 2010, increasing the deficit for that year. This break-even target for the 11-month budget will actually turn out to be a small surplus because it'll cover the expenses that we didn't have or we had and didn't have the money to pay for with the retirement incentives. That's the projected surplus here. This year's budget deficit, without any relief actions, would amount to nearly $19 million. But with some of the things we're targeting, we can get it down to about $6 million. And we think that that's not a bad place to be. Let me explain that again. We've got about a $600 million operating budget, and a $6 million deficit is, by most accounting principles, a bit of noise, right? It's 1%, coming within one penny on a dollar of balance in your books. But the subsequent years from fiscal year 2013 on indicate that we would have continued deficits and therefore add to our accumulated deficit, and we wouldn't be able to return to some balanced budgets and begin to pay off the accumulated deficit until well into the middle of this current decade. So that's serious, and we have to do something about it. We've also noticed that there's a growing resource gap between ourselves and the competition. I mentioned the difference of nearly $60 million a year just on tuition fees. Now, if you have a province that's less generous than Quebec, then that 60 becomes 40, but it's still significant amount of money that we don't have that our competitors have. We have to, in order to maintain our strengths, we have to find new ways of growing, identify new resources and areas that we can grow in and areas that we can save on. We have to identify completely new ways of thinking about what we do at the university without losing our souls, right, without losing track of what our mission is. And we have to continue to enhance our quality, recognizing the constraints. And we're going to keep moving increasingly to greater local autonomy. The strategic reframing initiative that the principal has launched focuses on five areas. What can we do very differently? Again, not just incrementally, but radically transform the way in which we spend money at the university. How can we save? Or how can we generate additional revenues? How can we use the formulas that the Quebec government uses to fund us to enhance our revenues by our enrollment mix? What new things can we do with the philanthropic community? How can we engage in truly transformative, large-scale research without sacrificing the important breakthroughs that individual scholars make? And how can we encourage people to perform even more highly, perform better than they're performing now? And we think they're performing quite well, but how can they do even better with more incentives in place? So this achieving our strategic academic priorities was launched in the context of that strategic reframing initiative, and also with a strong sense that we have to measure ourselves better than we've been doing in the past. So we want to consult with the community about identifying our academic priorities that are based on previous strengths and also a roadmap for the future. Where do individual units and individual principal investigators think we should be going? How would we measure ourselves against the competition, and how would we know if we achieved the results that we wanted? How are we going to measure ourselves and analyze them? And then we're going to have recommendations about ways in which we can do this that are different, truly different than the ways we've done in the past. The purpose of building a strategic academic paper now is to acknowledge that for the last 5 years, we have made significant progress on the areas that we identified, that the SRI, the Strategic Reframing Initiative, with a set of recommendations will help us to understand how to put those resources to the best use, and that we can also sustain our future academic leadership and have a roadmap that'll take us out about 5 years. There's nothing magic about 5 years, and it has to be flexibly adaptive in terms of the things we want to achieve. The guiding principles that we're using in building this second version of the strategic paper is trying to get as many consultations as possible. I've gone to every single faculty council. I will have, at least by the end of March. I will have talked to Senate two or three times. I've gone to meetings of chairs and directors in most of the faculties. We really need to get coordination of this with other university plans, make sure that we have an unbiased analysis and a way of measuring our progress, and we want to make sure that it's sustainable in terms of our financial resources. 5 years ago, when I became the provost, I asked the principal if I could also be the chief budget officer of the university. And this probably shouldn't make those kinds of requests. But I did, because I thought we needed to make sure that the academic priorities of the university would be the basis on which we made resource allocations. So we started by having $20 million a year deficits. And as I just pointed out, we've got it down to a basically balanced budget. The problem is we can't sustain it. So we need to have some way of recognizing that there will have to be trade-offs, and there may be even contradictions in trying to achieve some of the things we want to achieve. This is a very hard slide to read, but basically there were 7 objectives in the strategic paper for 2006. We've made progress to date and where we want to go in 2012 and beyond. Our academic renewal plan really did work. We now have 1,630 tenure-track professors at McGill. Every year, we've increased revenues of the university, and over the last 5 years, we've brought those revenues in line, or our expenses in line with those revenues. We've had real quality hires. The dean has mentioned some of the people who in your faculty who have made a difference. We've achieved the targets, but now we need to have some new directions in what we want out of faculty hiring. The undergraduate student body and experience, we created the position of Deputy Provost for Student Life and Learning, but there have to be other things that we can do in terms of innovations in the delivery of our academic programs, and we've relaunched the cyclical review process for all of our academic units starting in September. Graduate studies, Marty Kreisworth is here. We've talked a little bit about the importance of graduate studies. We've increased the percentage of PhD students at McGill to the highest in the country. So if you take the proportion of students studying at any university and look at the percent of those students who are PhD students, McGill is the leader. So we've moved ourselves into that number. We're stayed in a number one position, and we've increased by nearly 28% the number of PhD students that we have. Our funding levels have become more competitive, but we still have a ways to go. We've looked at some interdisciplinary initiatives. The integrated program in neuroscience, I think, is one of the biggest so far a success in terms of the number of people who are interested in doing it. We created a new institute for the public life of art and ideas. We've got the genomics initiative, which Rich Levin talked about, and green chemistry, as well as the Alzheimer initiative. But we do need to think more about how we link some of those interdisciplinary research activities to our own teaching. Support services, we had an award winner this afternoon. It's important that we keep thinking about ways of getting best practices into play, professional development activities for the admin and support staff, and then measuring ourselves with a program of analytics. We've made progress in increasing tenure track. We've increased our research at the faculty level. Doctoral funding has increased. We've gotten the new interdisciplinary programs. We've improved student services. And we now have a tighter integration between academic planning and the budget process than we ever had before. The starting points for this new strategic plan are to be more innovative in the way in which we deliver our academic programs and to think differently about our pedagogy, to promote growth and enhance support for our academic programs, to make sure we remain competitive in graduate studies, that there are new interdisciplinary initiatives across faculties. I mentioned iPlay. It's one in which the Faculty of Medicine does play a role. That's the Institute for the Public Life of Art and Ideas. But there are 7 faculties and 60 faculty members who are participating, and they recently received a donation to support 5 PhD students for the next 5 years. So it's something that's attracting interest by the donor community. And I said earlier, new ways of thinking about philanthropy is also important. We also want to make sure that we have good support services and we analyze things. That's the reason that we have a strategic academic plan is to give us a bit of a roadmap about what we should be doing, how we should measure our success, and how we put our resources to those activities. So this is the starting point for that. We hope to finish the consultations by the spring and present the paper to Senate for approval in September. So your feedback is really important. Thank you. And I think we've left some time for questions, comments, suggestions, concerns. I left off criticisms and complaints because I figured they would come anyway.
Questions and observations.
We'll yes.
The microphone around.
About sustainability and the difficulties of sustainability. What is the main challenge in maintaining our recruitment?
Yeah, well, one of the problems that we've faced is that we have been able to balance our budget. I don't mean sustainability in the environmental sense, but in the financial sense. We've gotten to the point where we have a balanced budget. But to keep it balanced would mean to sacrifice some of the things we've already invested in, to start to erode the progress we've already made. If we want to stay on a trajectory to competitive graduate funding, maintaining academic staffing levels at approximately 1,650 people. If we want to invest in our resources, in our infrastructures, then we have to find alternatives to the revenues, to the ones we already have. So developing a sustainable plan is to link those desires to the opportunity to achieve them, and that requires thinking very differently about what we're doing now, because the incremental model just won't work anymore. We have to be more creative in thinking about our financing. Revenue-generating programs need to be considered. We have to be better at competing for the big grants. Let me just use research grants as an example. In 1999-2000, when the first Canada Research Chairs program was announced, McGill was slated to get 169 research chairs from Ottawa. The last calculation, we're down to only being entitled to 153. That's a loss of 16 chairs at an average of $150,000 each. So it's $2.4 million of revenue that we don't have to pay professorial salaries or support research activities. Everything leverages in Ottawa now, everything leverages off of Tri-Council funding. So the more Tri-Council funding you have, the more Canada Research Chairs you get, the more Vanier Graduate Fellowships you get, the more indirect costs, which is 20 cents on a dollar now, but you get 20 cents for every dollar of research you bring in, which helps us to meet some of the costs from the operating budget. You get more access to CFI dollars, and you have a higher probability of winning other competitions. So it's all tied together. So we have to figure out better incentives for our individual professors to make sure that they're applying for and winning those competitions. We do really well, but we've gone down, and we stopped about 2005 was the last real decline until this year that we faced in research funding, and then we faced another dip. Now, 13 of the top 15 universities in Canada all faced a dip. Only one grew and one remained constant, and the other 13 of the 15 went down. We'd rather be in the virtuous group than the group that's on a vicious cycle downward.
Thanks. As an American in the group who paid $15,000 a year to go to college in the 1980s, I'm wondering if you can explain to me how it cost $2,000 a year in 2010 to go to McGill. I mean, to me that seems a big problem, and I don't know what numbers you can present to the Quebec government to maybe have them rethink their current cost structure.
Well, we're looking for all the arguments we can get. The principal has been tenacious in her efforts with the Quebec government to convince them that we need to liberalize the tuition regime. Until 5 years ago, it was only $1,600. So, you know, when you think about it, a $100 increase on $2,000, which is what we'll have next year, is a 5% increase in tuition fees, right? So it's not very much. It's $100. But $100 times the number of students begins to add up. Starting in 2013, we think it's going to go up somewhere between $250 and $500 a year for 3 to 5 years. So we're lobbying on the tuition front literally every day. We're also lobbying them not to withdraw their support. And in December, at the meeting in Quebec City that the principal attended, the Minister of Finance, the Treasury Board, and the Minister of Education all agreed that Quebec wouldn't reduce its support to universities. And having said that, Bill 100 comes into effect and we have line item control. So it's a challenge when you're a publicly funded university in this province to deal with those tuition constraints. But we're trying to deal with them. We have six programs for international students have been deregulated. Over the last 5 years, if you're an international student studying science, engineering, management, or there's one more, law, then in those four plus a few sub areas that don't affect us, veterinary medicine and pharmacy, we don't have. those six programs for international students have been completely deregulated. Now, our international students who in other programs pay between $16,000 and $18,000 a year now to come to McGill. But in those other programs, we don't get to keep that tuition. The government takes it back, treats it as if we'd only collected the $2,000, and gives us a grant. So we're putting money into the Quebec system for those students. That's a penalty for having a large number of international students. But we are making progress on it. We're also trying to deregulate and to have more self-financing programs. And if any of you read the French press this morning, we were slapped on the hand and we're waiting for a hand to go into our pocket about our the self-funded MBA program that we're now running. I think it's a small price to pay for the principle that we should be able to manage our own affairs. And I got more questions when I taught introductory statistics.
You mentioned setting money aside for
research
projects. Yes. Could you mention a little bit more about that?
Yeah, we're expecting there'll be a call for another CFI, obviously. That's going to be one area. We're going to be concerned about having money in the budget that we can put to helping getting significant help on writing the applications. What we've found in the other universities across the country is that they've been much more attuned to what goes on in Ottawa than we are. And so they're on top of that from the very beginning. They know about what's coming. They hire professional help in to get the grants designed in a certain way. And even more than that, they're influencing, they're using what would be American lobbying techniques in Ottawa to make sure that their positions are well articulated. We're going to be doing more and more of that, so we have to have some set-asides. We also did some recruitment for the Canada Excellence Research Chairs. We don't have any. We won two, but when we finally went to get the candidates, they didn't come. So if you don't land your candidates, you don't get the money. So we had two, and we'd like to continue to invest in those areas because there may be another call for that as well. Rich, anytime you want to jump in.
What are your projections on numbers of students entering McGill over the next 5 or 10 years?
So overall, right now, we expect there'll be for undergraduate students enrolled at McGill next year, we're expecting a 1.5% increase. That's 330 more undergraduates than we have right now. We're expecting about 75 more master's students and just under 40 new PhD students. So about 400 more people than we have today should be here a year from now.
Are you taking into consideration the possibility the number of students coming from Anglo-CEGEPs may diminish considerably in the next few years? Yeah.
Yes. Right now, McGill has we have an ideal type that we're a university that we think we could be. We have about 50% of our students come from Quebec, and they're now evenly divided between Anglophone and Francophone students. So of our 50% of students who are from Quebec, they're half from the French CEGEPs and half from the English CEGEPs. Another quarter of our students come from somewhere else in Canada, a little more than a quarter, and a little more than a fifth of our students come from a country other than Canada at the undergraduate level. That's a very unique combination for a publicly funded university. And our international reach is out there. We're certainly interested in recruiting students, quality students, from wherever we can get them. And we're trying harder to get good yields on the students who we do admit. So we're not going to lower our standards. We're simply going to be more aggressive about going after the students. But we do realize that there's a demographic shift in the province, but we have already moved to about 50% of our CEGEP students coming from the Francophone sector.
There's another question back there.
You mentioned that you're projecting growth in the science and engineering, and I was wondering if you've got any figures to put to that.
We expect that the growth in the PhD programs in both science and engineering will go up considerably. And that, again, we're saying next year we want to have 40 more PhD students than we have today. That's not a huge leap. but we are. It depends on our yield from the applicants that we get. We are trying to work more closely with those governments and foreign governments that have been supporting their students to come to study internationally. So Marty Kreisworth has been active or part in some of the activities with the Chinese government, and we have been looking at other ways of bringing quality students here to McGill.
I have a question about, you know, something we hear a lot about these days, which is return on investment. And I don't know if you actually used that terminology, but I kind of hear it because you're talking about developing or investing in programs that have the ability to generate revenue.
Right.
I certainly hope that isn't going to be the only metric that's used when the university is deciding where to put its resources. So I'm just wondering what sorts of metrics are you going to use to decide if something's worth investing in or not?
It's a good question, and I did mention we don't want to do any of those things if it meant losing track of who we are and what we want to become. So as a research-intensive, publicly underfunded university that's also student-centered, all of those things matter. So we're not looking just to invest and hope to see a bigger return in some areas. Where there is a return, where we do get some self-financing activities, we're looking for incentives for the unit involved, for the faculty in which the unit is centered, and for the university as a whole, so that we can reinvest in those areas that are clearly underfunded by the provincial government. We would not have, let me just give you two examples. We have, purposely not about medicine, we have the best faculty of music in the country. 80% of all of the research dollars that go to faculties of medicine in Canada come to the Schulich School. So we've made a conscious decision to invest in music. If we were to depend only on the amount of money the Quebec government provides to educate students in music, it would barely be able to support itself. So we've made an internal shift. We're not asking it to return the dollars. We're asking it to return on real performance, not just the musical performance, and to make sure that we continue to have a leading school. The other is the Trans-Systemic Law Program, which is unique in the world right now, but which has been written up in American law reviews and in Europe as a model for what legal education should be. It's bilingual, bijuridic, trans-systemic. Again, if we depended on the Quebec government to fund it, it would be a mediocre law school. It's an excellent law school because we've invested in it. The opposite side of that coin is someone else, somewhere in McGill, is making a sacrifice to allow for those kinds of internal subsidization and transfers. But those are the decisions that I think that's what I'm paid for, right? To make some of those decisions.
If I could take a piece of that, this issue of return on investment is something which conservative governments in the West have been demanding of universities really for the first time in the 1,000-year history of the university. And the response that some of us have been offering to the governments is very simple and defends what we do in the Faculty of Medicine. And as we develop metrics which will only show the quality of what we do in the Faculty of Medicine, further support that. In the 20th century, what we did collectively doubled life expectancy. The doubling of life expectancy, in addition to the very small drag because of the cost of the aging associated with that, increases human potential and productivity unbelievably. And that is a direct product of the life sciences investigations. It's predicted in science by people who seem to know that the 21st century will see another doubling in life expectancy because of our activities. Now, we can't even begin to imagine what life will be like at 150 or 160. I hope we figured out how to improve quality by then as well. But in terms of arguing that we provide a return on investment that cannot even be measured by those two facts alone is really quite extraordinary. The kind of medicine that we practice at the end of this century will look so vastly different. The reliance on hospitals and intensive care units will be so diminished if all goes well, if we all are as successful as we imagine. So the kinds of metrics that we the Faculty of Medicine, are proposing for our own self-measurement involve the kinds of quality measures, the productivity on research grants, the dollars accepted, the H factors, the H indices, all of the things for which we have no problem defending, I think, and will do quite well, and will in fact be able to use those metrics to gain further foothold.
Seeing no other questions.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. In just a few moments, I want to cover a few things which speak to some of the issues that the provost has raised. I'm not going to spend much time talking about our strategic planning process, which we've discussed at every one of these meetings for the last 2 years. But it was designed to dovetail precisely with the white paper and the extension of the white paper as ASAP. So we had in phase one a focus on undergraduate education. Implementation is underway for the fall of 2012, and it speaks to the issues of novel pedagogy and new approaches to teaching our students. In research, the proposition of a faculty of health, which would combine our research activities in a way that might provide a bit of efficiency in the process. And the faculty life cycle team, which has already changed with the university, the way in which faculty are honored and recognized. We started this year phase two in the postgraduate education with five task forces focusing on the funding of postgraduate medical education, the learning environment, curriculum, evaluation of the residents, and the learning continuum across the entire spectrum of pre-medical to medical to postgraduate to lifetime learning. An interim report is expected in June 15th and a final report next November, and it's being done concurrently with AFMC's Future of Medical Education in Canada postgraduate project, in which McGill is a leader across Canada. We have the administration excellence planning underway, asking questions about whether the technique adopted at the University of Minnesota as probably the best example of hubs of administrators providing more services than we can currently provide to any given department is a way for us to go, and we're well along into that process. The strategic reframing initiative that the provost mentioned, a lot of involvement of individuals from the Faculty of Medicine, and we'll hear more about that in the next months. And then a consequence of some of what Tony mentioned with respect to the environment. We have been asked to, with the rest of the faculties in the university, to find a 2.5% cut in our budget for next year. The budget's $84 million, so it's about $1.8 million, plus a 1% cut for this year, for which we have not identified sources, and we have about a 3.5% total reduction for the Faculty of Medicine. Now, in prior years, we have taken the reductions, much smaller, 1.5% each of those years, in part to create dollars for priority pool, some of which come back to us, and in part reductions to those budget deficits, which now total over $100 million, as the provost indicated. We've taken them from monies available to us from soft sources within the faculty, the discretionary dollars available. We're not going to be able to do that for this year. And so we've put together a financial control board in a process that involved nominations by the chairs and a subsequent election to this group. It's, as you see, quite broad-based in terms of representatives from across the faculty, every area, and the administration, and we will challenge this group with the responsibility for coming up with novel approaches, approaches for efficiency, and ways in which we can minimize the disruption. Yale, in response to all of the things that Tony mentioned, had a 5% staff reduction. The University of California system had a 15% staff reduction, and we've had none yet. We have tried to place the reductions in areas which would not result in the reductions of programs or individuals, and it's going to be tough to be able to do that as we try and reach the balance that is necessary. So you'll be hearing a lot from the Financial Control Board going forward. We've made a proposal to the provost, which is under consideration now, about how we're going to find this 3.5%, and we will engage through the Financial Control Board and the Faculty Leadership Council through the department chairs as many of the faculty and staff as possible in this process. Not good news, but not anything like many of our sister institutions south of the border have had to face. And with the bad news, with the heat comes some light, and anticipated success. We have just released, Mariana Newkirk sent around the internal call for CFI7, and we must do well on this call, and we will organize in the faculty to make certain that we are as competitive as any other university in Canada for this, which will focus on renewing the base of equipment that was purchased with prior CFIs. So most of this will be leading edge funds, and there'll be a bit, we expect, in new initiatives as well. And as the slide indicates, we want to sell the scientific excellence and do just as well as we possibly can, reaping the greatest dollar benefit from this. And dollar benefits are ours. We are making history in the capital campaign. We were the first faculty in the university to reach our campaign goal of $130 million. We're up to $135 million. It's mostly in restricted funds, so it cannot be used to help the embarrassment of the moment. Michelle Joannis, our executive director, is here and deserves congratulations for this. And I tell you, despite the fact that we have only 2 years of the campaign remaining, we expect to double that amount to 260, and that will help. That will help us very much. So I'm going to stop with that and open the floor once again to further questions for Tony or me or anyone of your colleagues if there are any. Seeing none, let's have a bit of wine and open the conversation further. Thank you very much for joining us.